Hi everyone, last session of TechEd 2012. I'm glad you've come here. If you're a developer and you're going to expect code in this session, I'm afraid you're going to be disappointed. I'm going to be talking to you about Connect, but I'm actually going to be talking in theory of Connect as opposed to a coding session, but I'm hopefully going to make it as enjoyable as computer science can possibly be. My name's Lewis Benge. I've spoken 3 times at TechEd so far. Two times at this TechEd so far, and I've introduced myself in various different ways. But I work for an advertising agency, TBWA, Digital Arts Network, which is based all around the world. And I actually look after a team called the Devices and Integration Team. Basically means I get to play with wacky stuff day in, day out, and I get to set some of the most challenging tasks that I've ever had to do in my history of working in IT. But luckily for me, I was involved with Connect before Connect for Windows actually came out. I've been working with the Connect platform now as a developer for about 2 years. I actually wrote some of the early training material when we were trying to get the SDK out of research, and I worked with Microsoft Australia on trying to get Connect into the marketplace for developers. So it's a product I'm fairly passionate about. And when I work with developers on trying to get them to understand Connect, I always talk about innovation in 2 ways. And yesterday I presented on the .NET Micro Framework, and it was an innovation session about trying to think outside the box, looking at a product in the simplest fashion, but how you can apply that in different scenarios. This one is slightly different. People, when they see Connect, they automatically come to the association of what's on the Xbox, and the assumption is that is all you can do, is what we see on the Xbox 360. So to really truly understand what the Connect is, I'm going to break down the science behind it, exactly what's going on under the covers of the box, so we can try and understand how we can innovate by pushing the technology as far as we can. That means that I can't show you code because I'm not that good at code, and I'm not an engineer that sits in Redmond developing all these computer vision libraries. It wouldn't make sense for me to show you code. But what I'm going to try and do is explain these concepts to you and show you a couple of demos. I do want to put a disclaimer on this that the lights here do play up. This is lighting technology we're playing with, and I've already got one demo I can't show you because my camera is too slow and the lights are too high contrast. But all the Connect stuff seems to be working, but we may see a few little discrepancies. So before we understand what the Connect does, I kind of want to explain to you some of these computer vision concepts, but in the two-dimensional space. We've been able to do some of this stuff for a long, long time, but we haven't, and there's obviously a reason for that. We've had 2D cameras on PCs for as long as I remember, and we're getting to the point now where the cameras we're attaching are high-definition, high-frame-rate cameras at very, very low cost. So why have we only waited now for Connect to come along to start doing things like gesture recognition? And it's important to understand how some of this 2D stuff works before you can start applying the principles into how the Connect is actually seeing the world. So the first thing I want to kind of just briefly touch on is facial detection. It's the first thing you really see when you play with Connect. So you turn the Xbox 360 on, and if you've got a Windows, an Xbox Live account, it says, hey, stand in front, stare at the camera, and it detects your face. And then it sends that off to Xbox, and it says, hey, Taboo Coder, which is my Xbox Live gamer tag, that's you, you can sign in now. And facial detection, it's a 2D concept. It's not new to the Xbox, to the Kinect whatsoever. We've seen facial detection for a long time. And one of my first jobs in IT, I actually worked in the Met Police, and I worked in an intelligence department, so the Met Police in London. And facial detection nearly 10 years ago was just coming into play for law enforcement. You have to run CCTV cameras through a database and try and pick out people then. So we've had it for a long time from government, and it's commercialized. And even today, when you plug your commercial cameras into your Logitech cameras and your Microsoft cameras in, you get this little a piece of bloatware that does stupid things like superimposes faces on you, and you can move around and stuff like that. So the way facial detection actually works, it's very, very similar to any other object detection that we have. We're taking an incoming video stream, and we're applying mathematical algorithms around it. So the one that's used quite common is an algorithm called the HAR classifier. And it's simply a recognition algorithm that allows you to take distinctive points out of an image, so like eyes, nose, bone structure, and actually save that into a database as a numerical sequence. And then as we're playing video across these algorithms, we can start taking out the frames, passing the image back through, start looking at these distinctive points and trying to find patterns that we can match. The second concept in 2D is a concept called dynamic background removal. Now I'm going to try and talk you through all three of these concepts in one demo in a sec. So dynamic background removal, it's a really, really important process in everything we're going to see in this presentation from now on. And this is something that we can do in 2D, we can do it in 3D, and it's using all types of technology that you'd have played with, but you don't even concept it. And the simple explanation of what dynamic background removal is simply the algorithms in computer vision are studying these images, and they're looking for pixels that move. And when the pixels are moving, it means that it can remove the background and you're left with a silhouette. So the best example of this is this image that I've put up on the screen here. We've got the standard RGB video that's coming in from the webcam, from a high frame rate webcam. And if I'm just standing like this and the webcam's watching me, it's going to assume that I'm in the background, I'm not moving, and it's just going to completely remove me. But if I have some variation in my arm and my body, it will start to determine that variation as me moving, and then we'll be able to start physically removing the background out of them, out of the image. It does this using just a black and white image, a grayscale image, and it's because it's a lot easier to subtract black from black and white from the image as opposed to going through the full color matrix of that video stream. Once we've actually got that background subtracted, we can then we have this silhouette which is ready for processing. And then you'll be familiar with this concept if you've seen Kinect of skeletonization. So we're taking this silhouette of me going like this, and I'm moving my arm, and we're just taking average points along the middle, and then we have a skeleton that we can start to work with. It's a process we can do with 2D cameras fairly well, and a process that is actually done quite often, and we don't see it, we don't appreciate how often it's being done in 2D. The underlying algorithm, if you want to know this, is what's written along the bottom there, which is local patched Gaussian mixture model. I don't really understand what that means, but when I was reading the white paper, the papers on some of this stuff, it was the one that stuck out to me the most. Last 2D concept, and I'll talk you through some of this stuff around the theory of how it's actually working in some demos. Optical flow. So optical flow is the ability to take these 2D images in and actually differentiate movement. And differentiating movement to a human is quite easy. We see something and we can say, yes, that's moving. But how do you tell a machine that something is moving? And this is the underlying algorithms that allow us to do this. The specific algorithm which I've learned is the Lucas-Kennedy algorithm. And the way this works is we're taking points, we're specifying points that we want to study in this optical flow scenario. So it might be pupils of an eye, it might be specific points, just generic structured points in these images and these video streams that we want to monitor. And then every frame we're getting in from this video, we're then looking for the differences between them. And the differences can then determine movement, it might be left or right. And this gives us this directional flow, which we can then pass into computer vision libraries, can then pass into our programs, and we can determine movement in 2D video. So I just want to quickly show you this video, just to explain optical flow in a more visual sense. So what this is a couple of guys had gone and picked up a quadricopter, and they wanted to try and automate this quadricopter by using computer vision libraries. And the way they've done this is by using a library called OpenCV, and they're using the optical flow functionality. And the blue specks you see are points they're monitoring, and then the red streaks you see is the actual optical flow. It's a direction of movement. So what happens is the quadricopter takes off, and then it's detecting movement. As soon as it sees movement, the quadricopter then follows that movement. It's a little bit blurry because I downloaded it from YouTube. So, so quadricopter's taken off, and you can see them red streaks. And red streaks are the movement that the library's given us back. And you'll see the guy walks down the corridor, and he's moved forward. So the quadricopter has fallen and it's moving forward. All this is being done on a high frame rate, high definition 2D camera. It's allowing us to determine movement just by using something we have access to on a day-to-day basis. I actually done this for 4 minutes, and it got really boring after a while. 2D gestures. This is the demo I wanted to show you, but the line situation here makes it a little bit more difficult. So when we have this dynamic background subtraction and optical flow combined together, essentially what I can do is I can stand in front of my webcam, and I can stand there for I can take myself out of the frame, I can measure the background, I can put myself in the frame, and I can start moving my arm up and down. I can pass that into a library that I'm a .NET library called aforge.net. And what that does is it actually does all the heavy lifting for me, does the dynamic background subtraction, and it does the optical flow, and it's saying that based on the silhouetted version of me and a skeletonized version of me, I can move my arm up and down, and I can wave, and using 2D, just using 2D input video and some C#, I can start recognizing gestures. So this function, actually, like I said, we've had it for a while. We've been able to go up to our computer and kind of wave to unlock and bits and pieces like that. What I will do, though, is I'll show you a quick demo on just the facial, on some of the object detection stuff. Okay, so what I have down here, I've got a little WinForms application that's actually it's doing object detection. It's using this HAAR classifier algorithm that I was talking about. Again, using a computer vision library, standard webcam, built-in webcam to the top of my computer. It's actually relatively low frame rate and relatively low quality. But what you can see is it actually it's recognizing patterns. It's recognizing my face. It's recognizing my mouth if I move closer, and potentially my nose and my eyes if it can pick that up. What I can do is I can actually I can take screenshots of these applications, of these frames. And then if I actually open up the directory where this application is stored, I can't find the directory, but if I found the directory, I'd be able to show you the raw cataloged information it's actually collecting, which is just, they're very basic screenshots. They're being categorized by the software and indexed. I can then load them back into the application through the computer vision libraries and train it back up again to start recognizing my face. And that way, if I stand in front of my computer, it's going to say, that's Lewis, because the databases of images we had, there's about 25 images of me there in different poses, smiling, frowning. It's starting to recognize me. So we get to do, we've just standard webcams and the more advanced 2D cameras we have access to. Working in the job I do, I get access to high-definition cameras that go 60, 80 frames a second, so they're very fast, very accurate cameras. We can do some very, very interesting things using standard computer vision libraries. I'm having big issues with PowerPoint today. I need to untick presenter mode. Okay, let me just quickly jump forward with my slides. All right, I'm using Office 2013, and this is the third time I've used PowerPoint, and it's changed slightly differently, and it's given me some issues. Okay, so jumping quickly back to what I was talking about. We've seen this stuff before. We've seen dynamic background subtraction, and we've seen optical flow. And the most obvious place that we've actually seen it, and you wouldn't have thought about how this was actually working, is the original Microsoft Surface, this big table which was really heavy and very chunky and very difficult to move around. And these surface units, they're actually commodity nowadays. They're very, very easy to build yourself, and they've actually a whole open source community around building these touch units. And the Microsoft Pixel Sense, the new style one, it works slightly differently, and that's why it's still being built by Samsung and still going out as a unique touch unit. But the original Surface unit, that they come up with this concept called rear diffused illumination. So what they was doing is they was putting an infrared light underneath, so they had an infrared light coming out of the top of the box. And then they had just a normal 2D camera underneath. And what they was doing is dynamic background subtraction. They was watching upwards. They was watching to the sky, and they removed the background surface. And as soon as someone put their fingers or an object on the surface, it reflected the infrared light back into the camera, removed it, and it was just silhouetted points. Them silhouetted points were then simply converted into vectors in regards to the screen and sent back into the application. At that point, we had points of touch. It's that simple. It's not a difficult concept to actually build. And that's why there's a whole group of people that are out there now building very, very advanced touch surfaces using the same infrared illumination concepts. And I've seen whole bars, whole like nightclub bars, where you can put drinks coasters down and roll oranges and stuff, and it's responding to touch. And it's using these simple 2D techniques. And it's using a library and a protocol called Twilio and an application called CCV, which is the computer vision libraries. I talk a lot about the computer vision libraries I play with, and these are the most popular ones. If you're a .NET developer, the first two are going to be the ones you'll want to pick up if you want to play around with some of this stuff at home. And OpenCV is the biggest one. It's a C++ library with a couple of C# wrappers around it. I think we can even use this one in some Win8 applications as well. We can start bringing streams from media capture APIs into these computer vision libraries. And specifically, I've seen a couple of OpenCV C# wrappers have allowed us to do some fun things there. AForge.net is it's a computer vision library specifically engineered for the .NET framework. It's very unusual to do everything in computer vision using pure .NET because the interpretation, the IL, adds latency and it means that we're going to get slow processing times for computer vision and media processing. But the OpenCV library, it's a native library, so it runs very, very fast. So using that P-invoke and marshalling backwards and forwards to that library, letting the library do the processing and handle it back to a managed object is a good way of actually getting the speed and the dexterity there. But, and I asked the question, like, if we can do all of this, if we can do gestures in 2D and we can do facial recognition in 2D and we can do motion tracking in 2D, is it plausible? Can we build solutions with this? And sadly, it is. Like, there's a company in Australia called Spinifex, and they work across the whole of the US. And most of their stuff is done in 2D. This is an exhibition in Hong Kong. I think it was an opening of a conference center or something similar to that. And you've got all these people walking through, and it's taking their input through high frame rates. They're waving, and it's actually allowing them to interact with these objects on the screen. Very, very similar to a Kinect experience you would see today. One of the scenarios I had to build out earlier this year is the marketing, the advertisers at work came to me and came out with this great idea of, we've seen this Kinect solution, and we know that we want to do augmented reality. We know what augmented reality is, and we've seen Kinect, and we see it's really, really popular. So we want you to build this installation. And I got really excited. It's like, yes, this is going to be the first actual commercial build of Kinect I get to run with. I get to build this great scenario out, going like into 50 installs around various places. And then they put this rider on it of that we want to put it outside. And if you ever try to put Kinect next to a window or under lights like this, you'll see there's a degradation in the lighting structure. And that's because infrared, it's based on infrared light, and that's how it does its 3D. So the 2D alternatives is where we would normally go to if we wanted to do this kind of scenarios outside or in high illumination areas. It allows us to do a similar type of experience and harness this natural user experience that people are familiar with. That it's being taught to them by the Xbox, and we can apply that into, like for me, various advertising scenarios. But the future is 3D. 3D is where we want to be. The Kinect is 3D. We're seeing more and more interest in 3D. We're having 3D TVs. We're having 3D printers. Everything is 3D nowadays. So we need to understand exactly how this 3D stuff works and how we can actually start working with it. And originally, we kind of had this concept around called time of flight. And we've actually had this around for a while now. It's just been very, very expensive. And there's two different types of time of flight. This one is it's a pulsing time of flight. So what we do is we take light. We always plan with light. Cameras play with light. 3D sensors play with light. But in this scenario, we're taking infrared light. And because it's light, we know it moves at a constant speed. It moves at the speed of light, which is 3.18 or something of a second. It's a stupidly fast number. And we pulse that light, and then we wait for a reflection. And we know that we sent that pulse, and we get it back again. And that's how we can determine distance. It's a very, very similar technology to sonar. If you think of how sonar is working on a submarine, we're sending a beam of sound out. We're waiting for it to hit something, and then it returns to us. And because we know the speed of sound, it's just doing that same ping technique. And what that means is we're sending all these beams out, and we're getting it back, and we can start to build these 3D pictures up. But because it's pulsing, we get some degradation. There's always a gap in between. So you're going to get some fuzziness of the image that's constructed. So there's this alternative approach, which is time of flight continuous wave. And that's just sending a beam of light out, and it's continually going, and it's reflecting, and it's just one continuous stream. But because it's one continuous stream, you also get some issues. You get some motion blur, and objects can break the light up, and if you have interference, it's even worse because it's one beam, and that whole one beam will go, so you'll end up losing a whole part of the wave that's coming back again. So when the Kinect guys were trying to figure out how they were going to build this and how they were going to improve on these time of flight principles, they were looking at these, and they come up with a second concept. So this is just talking about how we actually extract this 3D metric from time of flight. So what we do is we measure along rays from the camera center through an image plane. So essentially, try not to read off the slides, but we're just waiting. We're calculating the time of the ray is returned, and that's how we're building these fuzzy pictures up. I'm actually going to come back to this. I want to talk about Kinect first, so structured light. That slide was slightly in the wrong order. Kinect uses this theory of a structured light scenario. So it's taken time, the time of flight, it's sending beams out. But what it's actually doing, instead of just sending random beams out, it sends them out in a more structured way. And it actually sends them out to try and form little triangles. So it's sending all these dots out, and each dot correlates to a triangle, and then the triangle starts to build these meshes up. And you get a better idea of how this is working if you actually watch what Kinect is doing under an infrared camera. So luckily for me, because I didn't have to look stupid, when Kinect first came out, some guy in the US decided to go and strap an infrared camera to his head, turn his lights off, and film his kids playing with the Kinect. And this is exactly what it looks like. So you see that bright light that looks like a laser, that's the Kinect. This is him with a torch on his head. And you'll see what's happening is the Kinect is not sending a single beam out. It's sending loads and loads of dots out. And these are structured. These aren't just random light beams that are flickering everywhere like a time of flight system. They're in a more structured and controlled way. And what that's allowing us to do is actually get that information and get a better, clearer image of 3D space. So I've talked about the triangulation. These speckles, as I say, they're very coordinated. They're very accurate as to where they're being placed on the image. And I want to show you exactly what this actually translates to in terms of the Kinect and a code demo. So if you've ever played with the Kinect, you'll kind of see this type of scenario when you install the Kinect SDKs. And what this is taking the RGB picture on one side, the depth picture on the other, or the vice versa. And it doesn't mean too much. So you've got a 2D image and a 3D image being projected to you on a 2D plane. So you're not really comprehending what's actually going on here. And that's where a lot of people get stuck around understanding these underlying Kinect principles. You can't actually see what's happening. So when this first came out, me and a guy called Andrew Tobin in Australia, we come up with this little application where we thought, wouldn't it be great if we could turn Kinect into a 3D scanner? I'm going to try and do this at arm's length to show some depth here, but I'm just going to hit this point cloud button. And all that's done is it's captured that shot, that 3D shot, and converted it into a point cloud. And a point cloud is quite a generic 3D file that a lot of applications can consume. So I'm actually going to load one up here called MeshLab, which is an open source freeware application you can download off the internet. And there's my point cloud, captured at 220, just to prove that it was the one I've just captured. So you can see my head there, you can see my silhouette. But what this actually allows us to do is kind of spin it around, and this is where the demo is kind of degrading because of the light a little bit, but you can see a little bit of that texture. You can see how that light is being projected out, it's mounting back in again, and then it's being translated into something on the screen. So you can exactly see where I was standing. What that should have done, because I'm wearing black, it doesn't like that as well. You know, black absorbs infrared, it doesn't reflect it. But that should have actually captured me as a bust of me and returned it, and I should have full 3D depth. They've always talked about this scenario of when we're getting this raw 3D information, wouldn't it be great if, like in the future, we had 3D printers? And when I was actually launching this, I actually borrowed a 3D printer from a guy here in New Zealand. And it's like, if we captured this and we captured these 3D busts, and like, maybe you was traveling, maybe you was an interior decorator, and you was in Paris, and you saw this fabulous lamp, and you wanted to show it to your client. So you took this lamp, and you stuck it in front of a Kinect, and it captured this raw 3D information. It was rendering this 3D image, and you sent it over the internet, because these files are tiny. They're just text files. You send it over the internet, and in the world of 3D printers, you print it out, and your client can actually see this lamp in 3D, and they can go and send it to China and get it pirated if they wanted to do that kind of thing. But this is the type of scenarios we're looking at. When we're looking at Kinect and we're understanding exactly what's going on underneath the covers, we're getting 3D scanners at consumer commodity prices. $200 for a piece of technology that 5 years ago would have been thousands of dollars in academia land. So it's very, very interesting stuff. Microsoft Research, I'm going to show a few research videos, but they have very practical ideas of how this is going to be used. And these are the types of scenarios that are innovative. Just looking at what the research guys have done to bring Kinect to Xbox and then interpreting what's on the Xbox back into WPF and into your Windows application, it's not really innovative. It's more following it like a sheep and kind of bringing them experience consistently across just to build these up. Like, it's a great foundation knowledge, but you're not pushing that threshold of the technology. And luckily, because research understands underlying principles that I'm trying to explain most probably fairly badly to you guys today, that they can actually try and push these boundaries a little bit further. And this video was from an event called Microsoft Tech Fest. It's a two-minute video, so I'm going to grab a glass of water while it plays. But they're just looking at how these types of 3D scenarios are going to play out in the future a little bit.
Hi, my name's Shiram Azadi. I'm a researcher from Microsoft Research Cambridge in the UK. Today I'm going to present to you Digitize Your World. It's a really cool technology that makes Kinect cameras really come alive, allowing you to scan in 3D models, 3D geometry of your entire room very quickly in real time, just using this cheap Kinect camera and some clever software. So I'm going to jump straight into a demo. Here we have a Kinect camera, and behind me we have the 3D model that's generated as we're moving this Kinect camera within our space and scanning in the 3D geometry. So in front of us we have a coffee table with various objects on it, and you can see this high-quality 3D model is being generated in real time and updated in real time. So for example, if I move up close to the keys on the phone, you can actually start to see that detail on the 3D model behind us. Or if I actually move the fruit bowl out of the scene, you can see it fade away. And it's not just a 3D model of of objects within the space. It's actually a 3D model of the entire space. So if I actually pull back, you can see we're generating a 3D model of a large area of the space. So for example, we're actually capturing the keys on the keyboard or the monitor. Another example might be 3D scanning a person. So if my colleague actually walks in, behind us we can see a 3D model being generated in real time of him, and we can actually see that we can capture details such as smile or facial expressions right down to the wrinkles on his shirt. So we're really excited about the possibilities that this technology enables. One might be new types of gaming scenarios where you can scan in physical objects and have them within the digital game. So imagine being able to scan in a skateboard and have that appear within the game. Or even scan in your whole body and have you as the Xbox avatar. So this is really about bringing the physical to the digital.
My mic's gone. So that's what researchers are looking at, or were looking at. That was a video I actually played for Imagine Cup students as they were going through the first rounds of Imagine Cup earlier this year. So this is 12 months ago. Since that time, this has actually been released on Xbox 360, and not a lot of people know about it. There's object recognition on Xbox 360 through the Kinect, through an application called Kinect Fun Labs. It's a free application you can download if you're an Xbox Live member. And it's something that's kind of designed for kids, but there's a lot of underlying principles in there that can easily be brought across to enterprise applications, to unique uses of the Kinect that aren't based entirely around skeletonization and inputs. One of them is a concept called googly eyes. And I'm not sure whether anyone would have played this, because I'm pretty much the only one that's a fan of this thing. And what the actual concept was is you could take soft toys, so like a little Winnie the Pooh teddy bear that's sitting on the end of your bed or something like that, and you can actually stick it in front of the Kinect scanner or the Kinect sensor, and it'll ask you to hold it up and then ask you to turn around. And it'll actually capture that 3D mesh, and it'll capture a photo, and it'll wrap the photo around this 3D mesh, so you end up with your teddy bear in the Kinect, in the Xbox, on the TV. And then it'll stick the googly eyes on it, and then it'll also skeletonize it, so you can then start going like this, and Winnie the Pooh on the screen is starting going like this. It's a very, very basic concept, but it's allowing us to bring 3D avatars from real life back into that gaming scenario. There's also, like, looking at what I was talking about in terms of facial recognition and trying to detect facial features and object recognition, they've gone one step further, and they have this avatar scanner on Kinect Fun Labs as well. So I can go in and I can stand in front of the Kinect, and it will scan me in, and it will capture a photo of me, and it will then try and construct an Xbox avatar out of my image. So it'll look at my face and then go, I've got a pointy nose and I've got short hair, and it will try the best out of this catalogue of features it has to try and construct this avatar. And then it'll actually then analyse, based on the skeletonization of my silhouette, apply that over the top of the photo, and it'll say, well, this arm is black, so he must be wearing a black shirt that's actually long sleeve. So it then applies that colorization into that avatar. So they're doing a lot of computer science to build that up for a fairly impractical purpose, because that avatar literally sits on my phone and on my Xbox, and it waves at me when I sign in. And this kind of stuff is being done in the gaming world, because that's the uniqueness of Kinect. It's that consumerization. It's that bringing it into the Xbox. It's lowered that price point, and it means they can start generating money off of it. But these concepts, if you understand these concepts, they're very fundamental into building real-life applications out and innovating with the Kinect. Exactly what he was showing in that video is a perfect scenario for law enforcement. Going back to my days in the police, if we went to a crime scene, we would have to work as fast as possible before that degradation of evidence, and we'd have to make sure that everything went across in a fine-tooth comb, because we'd never be able to recreate that crime scene. If you can walk along with a couple of scanners for a couple of hundred dollars each and just wave them up and down, and it's constructed this whole 3D crime scene that you can then take back and analyze, it's like something out of like CSI. It's future thinking, but it's technology that's pretty much available now. Kickstarter is my favorite thing at the moment, and if you were in my session yesterday, I mentioned Kickstarter as well. That's how popular it is with me, because of the hardware innovation that's being pushed there. But there's this product that was being released called the Oculus 3D. I've seen a few nods, so I think people are kind of seeing this one on the blogs. This is a virtual reality headset This allows you to stick a headset on and actually play Doom in 3D. But could you imagine combining that with the ability to actually scan in a 3D world and actually have this 3D mesh and bring that into the into gaming or into alternate virtual reality scenarios? It's outstanding around just this one feature of Kinect, this depth feature, how far you can actually try and push this functionality. So the next feature of the Kinect hardware is audio. I'm going to touch very, very quickly on audio because it's a fairly fairly basic scenario. We've had microphones for a while, but audio was included in Kinect on purpose for a few reasons. And firstly, voice is more intuitive than movement. Like we communicate on a day-to-day basis via body language, but we also communicate via we communicate vocally. It's easier for us to try and explain something to someone in words than try and move my hands and do like an interpretive dance to explain it to you. So it's a lot easier for people to engage with a device by speaking to it and the device understanding you. Voice is also social. So in the gaming community, we've always had this ability to jump on the web and shout at people in Germany while you're playing Medal of Honor and stuff like that and actually have all the swearing and stuff in your ears. It's something that is a big part of gaming. And it's a big part of any type of input interaction. If you look at how successful Siri was with Apple and that natural engagement with a device, because it's social, you feel like you're engaging with another person instead of a machine. The voice can also be, it can modify, be combined, or replace gestures. I remember playing Medal of Honor, Rainbow Six, or one of these games where I had the headset on and you'd shout, move left, and the player, your team would kind of move left, and that was the computer responding to you. And it's a lot easier than me trying to use a controller and also go like this to the Xbox. And that's why it appeared there. It appeared there for fundamentally gaming reasons, but it's a piece of hardware we can make use of in the Kinect for Windows SDK as well. If you was at TechEd last year, Bronwyn and John, who's Sole Solutions, they would have most likely presented this a little bit better than me, because they went and brought a Kinect and actually stripped it down, and they can take the whole thing apart. I've only got a picture on the slide deck, so it's not as good. But the audio equipment within the Kinect is actually really, really good. We've got an array of four microphones in the Kinect, and they actually sit either side of the cameras. And these four microphones have a very wide range of input. They have noise suppression technology built in as well. So you can have a fairly noisy game playing in the background, and you can say, Xbox, stop. And the Xbox will still be able to determine that you've said that because it can cancel that noise out. Okay, the magic of Kinect when it comes to audio as well is being able to combine the audio inputs and the skeletal inputs from Kinect. And this is kind of moving into the next session, which is looking at the middleware of Kinect. But if we've got four microphones which can kind of determine detection because it can hear where the sound is coming from. But if we also combine that with the skeleton, we can work out which player is saying what, and based on facial recognition, we can respond to that. And this kind of comes into play when we look at what Xbox are doing with the interactive TV scenarios. So I'm not sure, I think it was in the keynote, the Sesame Street example that was shown at CES earlier this year, which is where they've actually made an interactive TV version of Sesame Street, which plays on the Xbox, plays on your big screen TV, and allows children to interact with the TV episode through the Kinect. And what all they're doing is there's a couple of kids there, and they're talking to Elmo and Cookie Monster. But you know the way kids are, they can kind of move left and right, move right. But the Kinect is able to keep up with them, and that's a combination of the four different microphones picking up sound in certain quadrants of where they're listening, but also skeleton tracking and working like, hey, Lewis, you've said that, and now you're over here, but you're still talking to me, and then Cookie Monster being able to respond accordingly to that. So you can have some fun with audio. It's a very, very rich very, very rich hardware and an even richer API. Jumping ahead of myself, the actual audio APIs on Windows is the Microsoft Speech Framework, which has been around for like 5, 6, 7 years now. It's a .NET API, very, very easy to use, and it's all text-to-speech related. So it actually had its basis in Speech Server, which has now moved into Link Server and designed for IVR systems. But it's now very, very responsive. And if you try tying that back into more intelligent systems, you can have this Siri-like functionality where you can talk to a computer and it can determine what you've said. You can pass that through a sentiment engine and then try and determine keywords, pass them through a search engine and bring it back. So voice is a very, very important technology, but it's kind of a little side piece onto where Kinect is going. The biggest question that I do get asked is all this stuff that I'm talking about in terms of 3D space, is it unique to Kinect? And the structured light stuff is a little bit more unique to Kinect, like Microsoft kind of pioneered that stuff and brought it down in price, but there are other time-of-flight sensors out there that do an equal, if not a better job in some ways. The middle one is the Panasonic D-Imager. When I talked about the marketeers, the advertisers coming to me and saying they wanted to stick Kinect outside, I actually worked with Panasonic on this product, and we actually took it out into the Sydney high streets and installed this time-of-flight mechanism into full sunlight street scenario, and it worked. It was a time-of-flight technology that they managed to engineer to work in sunlight. So they kind of they had an alternative approach to Kinect. The big difference: the Panasonic D-Imager retailed in Australia around $3,000. So this is where kind of the balance is going. Microsoft have commercialized the technology, they've driven down the price, and that's where the innovation is coming from in Kinect, as well as the fact they have some advantages in terms of the way they process light. It's the price that is the big player here as well. But Kinect isn't just a sensor. When Microsoft Research actually developed the Kinect, they were under the restrictions given to them by the entertainment guys, the Xbox guys. Xbox has been like nearly 10 years old. It's a fairly old power PC sitting there with limited amount of RAM, limited amount of processing power. And they apply some constraints to you when you actually build Xbox applications. They say, well, if you're going to build a peripheral, you're never allowed to use more than 10% of the CPU because we need the rest for gaming. We need to squeeze as much power out of this as we can for gaming. It might be 5% of CPU. I can't remember the exact piece of information. So Microsoft offloaded some of that onto the sensor itself, but most of it's actually being done in firmware. So the Microsoft research guys actually spent a lot of time optimizing this firmware. And then, amazingly, they've come along and they've said, hey, developers, it's yours for free. Like, the licensing on Kinect is the software is free. You can use it in a commercial application. You can use the runtimes. And this is stuff they've been working on as scientists for a long time. When Kinect first came out, there was this big hacking competition. Like, there was even money put on Kinect of who can get Kinect up and running first before research actually released their SDK. And Microsoft were still working on a plan of how to go to market and the commercialization of this product. But what people managed to do, like, people are clever, they plugged the device in, they kind of monitored what was going on across the USB bus, and they decided to write these drivers around it. And then this product appeared called OpenNI, and a couple of other products appeared as well. All they're doing is they're actually going back to our 2D roots. They're using these computer vision libraries, mainly OpenCV because it's a cross-platform one, and they're just interpreting that raw 3D image and passing it through the same algorithms that I was trying to show you earlier and trying to explain earlier. So that's where the difference is with the OpenNI stuff and a couple of other platforms. Their roots are in 2D. They're not specifically designed for 3D processing. And that's why you might find there's some latency issues, or you have to do weird configuration things to get them up and running, because they're not specifically engineered for the hardware. Most people have kind of seen the 3D skeleton kind of things, so I'm actually going to skip that because I've only got a few minutes left. I was just going to talk to you exactly about how the skeletonization works in Kinect. It was actually a little bit more interesting when I had access to the Panasonic sensors. Unfortunately, I've sent them back to the people that own them now. Because I could actually dive into how Kinect was doing and how OpenCV was doing it as well, because there's a considerable difference. Again, when we come and look at middleware layers, there's a few different things we can use. Like, you can buy the Kinect scanners and Kinect sensors. And as I was saying, the commercialization of the Kinect sensor, it's in the hardware. To actually use this stuff on a commercial basis, you have to go and buy the Kinect for Windows sensor, and it's a little bit more expensive because that's how they've commercialized it. But at the end of the day, if Microsoft is generating the money off the hardware, they're not really going to care what middle layer you're using. So you could go and use the PrimeSense APIs, which are I think they're the guys that wrote some of the OpenNI. They legitimize some of the drivers there, and they have a middleware layer called Knight. And that actually works on OS X as well. At work, we use a platform called Unity 3D, which we normally use on Mac, and sometimes the guys use that just to kind of prototype some of the stuff. And it works. Olmec is another library I've used quite recently. It's an Israeli, company from Israel. They've kind of gone one step further with theirs. It's built on OpenCV as well, but it uses pattern recognition in a different way, machine learning algorithms. So you can actually go in and start teaching them the middleware gestures. So you can actually go into an application and hit record and kind of literally just wave backwards and forwards. And eventually the machine learning will start to determine that's how you wave. So you're not having to do anything in code. It's all very visual. You're recording, and then you can access them APIs via C#. Then Microsoft comes to the party with Kinect for Windows, which has been around for a while now, and we're on 1.5. And looking at Twitter, it appears we're kind of heading towards a new version of that as well. And this is a great API. And I'd really like to show it to you, but I've installed a different version on my machine just to try and get some of the demos working. But the Kinect 1.5 is doing some fantastic things with not just like facial recognition and the skeletonization and the depth, but there's also now this complete 3D head tracking and feature recognition that research have produced and pushed it through into the commercial SDK. And if you load it up, you can do things like track your eye movements, track your mouth movements. You can speak and it will track your lips. And there's some really fun things in there. And they make it more and more easier to use. There's a very rich WPF Explorer there now where you can download some samples and it will talk you through how to build the code. And they're understanding there was barriers there when this first came to market, but they're trying to knock them barriers down. And Soft Kinetic is an example of another library. There's lots of libraries. There's a lot more than what I've got on the screen here. So when I talk about gestures, this is one I do want to show, because gestures is something that's normally missed. You normally think about Kinect, and you're kind of expecting to get gestures out of the box. But the reason that Microsoft haven't done this is because they don't intend for you to copy the same gestures off the Xbox. So they don't want to package up these gestures and say, here's a set of gestures that you can use and bring them to Windows, and that's Kinect for Windows. That's a limitation. They really wanted you to think about how you was building these applications, think about user experience and how you was inputting. And a lot of people got relatively confused on how to build gestures because it's not the most simplest thing to do. And I always talk through this scenario. If I want to draw a circle and I want that to be a gesture, but then different people are drawing circles and I'm not making a complete shape or I'm moving left and moving right, there's a whole load of variation there. And when Microsoft built the Xbox Kinect, they actually run their gestures through machine learning to improve them and to refine them. And they've done a whole lot of beta testing where they sent loads of Kinects out to home users and they were continually recording what people were doing as inputs, and then they went through these massive great big computers that crunched it all down into the perfect refined gesture where we see on the Xbox today. And certainly that's not something that they wanted to release for free to the market. But what we do have is we have some really basic gesture libraries out there that we can use. So this one here, that's the one that doesn't work. Let me go to the one that does. So this one here is taken three distinctive gestures, which is swipe, wave, and the menu one, which is just holding your hand there and you get the beam that lights up. And it's actually broken the gesture down into a couple of distinctive parts. So swipe left, swipe right, and then segments. And every time we're getting the inputs in from the Kinect, and this isn't a code in the session, so I don't really want to show you the code, but this is available on the internet. It's a Microsoft sample that you can Google and you'll find it and be able to download it. But they're breaking these gestures down, and every time we're getting this skeleton in, they're pushing the skeleton points through, and they're just monitoring these gestures to actually get them up and running. So I'll quickly play this and show you exactly what they're trying to achieve here. So if I stand back and it can start to see my arms, I have to be over here, and I kind of go like this. It says I've swiped left. And if I do that with my right hand, it'll swipe right. And if I stand like this, it should say menu, but it doesn't. How about if I wave? So what these guys doing, and these were students who wrote this, they're taking the basic points of input from that skeletonized image that's coming off of the 3D projection, and they're just running it through some basic math of saying, you're moving these points in a straight line, you're taking the hand, they're always focusing on the hand, and you're moving it in a straight line, or you're moving it in an arc. And it's fairly basic math, but there's no tolerance there. So if I always say to people, how do you wave? And some people wave like this, and some people wave with big arcs. And so the tolerance isn't there to actually differentiate between the types of waving, and that's where the machine learning stuff comes into it for Microsoft Produce. The other thing to note about 3D gestures as well is when Microsoft have built the Xbox experience, they've built it in such a way where they actually teach you how to use some of these gestures. So if you actually look at how the Xbox is presenting itself, it actually has a big sweeping arc in front of, at the bottom of the screen when it wants you to move your arm. And it has big arrows telling you how to actually move backwards and forwards. And that's always really important when you're trying to explain 3D gestures to people, because as I said earlier, it's natural for you to communicate in voice, but not necessarily natural for you to communicate in body language. You don't notice yourself moving your arms backwards or forwards and how you're standing. So someone telling you to wave, like most people will wave like this, but there isn't the movement there for the camera to actually detect that kind of gesture. So big sweeping movements, you need to put that on your UI to try and get people to understand this kind of stuff. So all of this, this Kinect technology has been built with light. But there's limitations of light, and being on a stage like this, I can see the limitations quite clearly, and being out in the wild, having to put stuff in the street and stuff like that, working in coffee shops, if I ever wanted to build this stuff into a PC, so having the Kinect sensor in the PC and just having these inputs, it's going to be very difficult. Light is very, very restrictive. So why can't we do it with sound? And again, that's kind of what Microsoft have been asking themselves. Why can't we do it with sound? And they're getting pretty close. This was, again, another short two-minute video that Microsoft released earlier this year about how they're actually refining the Kinect-style interfaces, natural interfaces, using sound waves.
Gestures are becoming an increasingly popular means of interacting with computers. However, it is still relatively costly to deploy robust gesture recognition sensors in existing mobile platforms. Soundwave is a real-time sensing technique that leverages a speaker and a microphone to robustly sense in-air gestures and motion around a device. It is capable of detecting a variety of gestures and can directly control existing applications without requiring the user to wear any special sensors on their body. To sense motion, this technique uses the Doppler effect, which describes the change in frequency as a result of relative motion between a sound source and an observer. Soundwave uses existing speakers on a device to produce inaudible tones of frequency between 18 to 22 kHz. Our system then uses the microphone on the same device to pick up the frequency-shifted signal to recognize the gesture. Here we see the tone produced by Soundwave and the shift in frequency around it as a user moves his hand closer and farther from the PC. As the hand moves faster, the change in frequency is also greater. Variety of gestures can be realized by measuring characteristics of the sense signal such as speed, amplitude, direction, and time variation. By combining direction of the motion and its variation over time, the user in this example can change the direction of scroll by performing a double tap gesture. Using the number of motion events generated by sound wave, walking towards or away from the laptop can be uniquely detected. In this example, it is used to lock a user's computer screen as he walks away. Soundwave is robust to audible sounds. For example, music can be playing on the same device as Soundwave is running on without affecting its sensing capabilities. This example application also demonstrates the use of two-hand gesture. Here we see a user playing a game of Tetris by performing different gestures. Slow tapping gestures are used to move blocks left while faster taps towards the right. Two-handed gestures are used to flip and pulling the hand back in a quick stroke drops the block. This example demonstrates the accurate and quick control that Soundwave is capable of. To establish the robustness and reliability of Soundwave, we tested it in a busy and noisy environment.
So this is a great example of when you understand the underlying technical principles that the hardware is trying to achieve, how you can innovate using that. So they've taken this time of flight principle and applied it to sound. They're sending out sound beams, similar to how that sonar thing works. And they're using the frequency of sound to then come, like the frequency of sound based on the reflection to then determine gestures. Their research, obviously, they spend their time innovating all the time. But they do so by understanding the hardware that they're working with, and that's how they get great results. So I kind of just wanted to draw a conclusion as to why we've gone from 2D into 3D and where Kinect is going and why we should be using it. And like I say, I've been using Kinect now for a year and a half, and it's one of my favorite devices. I've shown a whole range of technology since I've been at TechEd, and my suitcase is so jam-packed with security that if I was flying into the US, I'm sure I'd get picked up by the TSA just for all the electronics I have in there. But Kinect is one that we can innovate with. It's so flexible, and the APIs are so open. But we're only at that tip of the iceberg as to what people are starting to do with it, because they're not thinking out of the box enough in terms of the technology. And I think that's because they don't really understand what it's doing. They're looking at the Kinect as simply a new mouse, a singular input device, when it's three or four combinations of technology, plus everything we can do with 2D imaging combined. The reason that it's important to us is because it's a commodity device as well. They're so affordable now that I've seen them for $99. I can go and buy these cheaper than any other peripheral device, apart from maybe a printer. And I can attach it to my computer, and they're virtually disposable. And they're not indestructible, but if I break one, I can go and just pick another one up, and I can strip it down. Like, I shouldn't be saying strip it down and stop playing with it, but that's how you understand these things, and that's how you can try and push the boundaries with it. And that's why it's better to use a Kinect over the competitors, because Xbox has managed to drive down that price, and it's opened up this whole breadth of experience that people, general consumers that don't understand exactly what's going on, they can pick it up, they plug these things into the Xbox, they start playing the games, and then they come along to your experiences, to your applications, to digital signage and bits and pieces like that, and they're starting to expect this technology to adopt. And we need to understand these principles and bring them across into these applications. We've seen this vision video a few times. I love this vision video. I'm just going to finish off with it, and that will be the end of the presentation, and everyone can go and get some drinks in the bar. But the vision video for me, this opens the door as to innovation. This is when we think of this technology and how we should push the boundaries of it. Some of the ideas here are absolutely fantastic, and they're all based on real ideas. They're all based on conversations that people have had with IEB and research around what they wanted to do. My personal favorite is the bomb disposable robot, because that was a conversation I was having a while ago from my law enforcement backgrounds about how great it would be. But I play that, and that's the end, and I thank you for your time today.
We started with a sensor that turned voice and movement into magic.
Xbox, play.
And we thought, this will be fun to play with. And it was. But something amazing is happening. The world is starting to imagine things we hadn't even thought of. Unexpected things. Hopeful things. Beautiful things. Inspired things. Which is why, even though the world keeps asking us what we'll do with Kinect next, we're just as excited to ask the world the same thing.
Thank you for your time, and I hope you enjoyed TechEd 2012.